perhaps a little bit. I'd like this talk this morning to be a continuation of last week's talk, the last time I talked, in that a little bit what I want to do is to express or to share a little bit the passion I have for Buddhism with you all. And I have a very, very deep appreciation and almost a passion for Buddha's way. And more than anything else. And I think some of you who heard me talk and kind of get all excited about talking about Buddhism have witnessed a little bit at times. And sometimes a little bit embarrassing for me, but I tend to get quite impassioned by it. Now in the beginning, we chanted this opening chant, and we paid our respects, our homage to the Dharma. And kind of more superficially, the Dharma in that chant is the teaching. We're talking about the teaching, unsurpassed, perfect teaching. And but I think more deeply, it isn't the teaching that necessarily the Buddha taught, but it's the teaching that we all have already that comes from our own awareness, our own kind of jewel mirror awareness, luminous awareness of how things are each moment. And the Dharma reveals itself. Teaching reveals itself to ourselves as we're aware. And so as I practiced Buddhism over the years, slowly there was kind of a little dawning or glimpses of this Dharma, of this kind of awareness that's possible. And I had deep appreciation and love for it. And a few years ago, I started to learn to appreciate the historical Buddha, or the Buddha, the person who kind of founded or started these teachings, set them in motion. And he started something 2,500 years ago, which we're a continuation of right now. The fact that we're together in this room is a continuation of his intention and effort and what he started so many years ago. And so as I started getting some glimpses of the Dharma in my practice, I also started getting some sense of some idea, some hint, intuition of what a Buddha's mind might be like. And it's kind of awesome. It's one of the awesome things in life. Tremendously beautiful. Awesomely beautiful. The idea of what a Buddha mind is like. I think all of us have had some kind of glimpse of beauty in our practice, in our life. And if you imagine that beauty extended in an unlimited way, then you kind of have a Buddha's mind. So traditionally, at the beginning of a talk, Buddhists wouldn't pay respect to the Dharma. They pay respect to the Buddha. And they have a very ancient language in which they do it with. And the oldest living way of paying refuge to the Buddha, I'd like to chant for you.
Namu tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
You're paying refuge to the arhat, the awakened one, the perfectly self-enlightened Buddha. And one of the things the Buddha talked about a lot, he repeated often, was a very simple phrase, which was, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. And then starting from there, he taught the middle way, the middle path. And I'm sure all of you have heard before, you know, that people mistake Buddhism as being pessimistic or life-negating, emphasizing a lot of suffering. And to a certain extent that's true, and it's very important to come to a very deep understanding of suffering in our lives. And it's very difficult, actually, to understand suffering. It's easy in some ways, it's right in front of us, but the deepest wells of suffering that make up our life in the teaching of the Buddha aren't really understood until the end of the path when you're fully enlightened. And but on the other hand, Buddha also talked a lot about joy and happiness. And the Buddha way, the practice of Buddhism, is packed full of joy and happiness, compassion, friendliness, love, joy, kindness, faith, buoyancy of the mind, pliancy of the mind, lightness, enlightening of the mind. And he talks a lot about all these wonderful emotions and qualities that get revealed as you start practicing. And he said, another quote he's known for saying, is the way to enlightenment is through happiness. So he taught the middle way. And my understanding of the middle way, one of the ways of understanding it, is that it's the middle way between wanting and not wanting, between holding on and pushing away, between desire and hating. And what that means is that we're completely open, very open heart, very spacious mind. And there's no choice. It's kind of choiceless awareness. There's no choice about what our experience is. And in Buddhism, what we're experiencing doesn't matter at all. And people are often confused about that. They think that it's important to have some particular kind of experience when they sit or when they're alive. And in Buddhism, it's not necessary to have any kind of particular experience. It's not necessary to have experiences of joy. It's not necessary to have experiences of suffering or sorrow. What's necessary, the point of Buddhism is not what you experience, but how you experience it. So the middle way is talking about how to experience what's going on. And they're talking about experience it with an open heart and a spacious mind. So whatever comes up, you allow to come through you. Let everything be. And the process of doing that, your whole humanity will pass through your eyes, pass in front of your eyes. And there's a lot of joy, a lot of happiness that will come. And there's also a lot of pain. And in some ways, the more I practiced, the more sensitive I've gotten. And the stronger my emotional life has become. So rather than having my emotional life becoming smaller as I practice, it's actually gotten a lot stronger. And I feel things much more than I ever did before. And my heart sometimes feels like it's going to break. It just feels very pain sometimes when I see suffering around me. And other times I'm just filled with light and happiness. And I think that when I somehow love this, all of it. It's kind of like my relationship to the Buddha's way. It's kind of like a love affair. I feel it's a tremendous vitality that comes from this kind of contact, this kind of openness. It happens on many levels. When I was at Tassajara before, in the early 80s, I remember there was the Israeli bombing of Beirut. And, you know, I'd grown up in the Vietnam War and you know, reading the newspapers, and we all know what's in the newspapers. But it wasn't until I saw the Newsweek photographs of the bombing of Beirut that I think I really felt for the first time the tremendous pain and suffering of war. I think one of the reasons was that I was just open. Being in Tassajara just became so open. And also because Beirut was very close. I'd been to Beirut when I was small, so I knew it. And also, it's a very European city, very Mediterranean. Maybe you saw some of the photographs of how it looks. And it's right on the Mediterranean. And I also grew up for many years on the edge of the Mediterranean in Italy. So it was just very close, I felt. So it was like next door was happening. This bombing, it wasn't so far away anymore. Vietnam is very far away. And And in Israel also, I also grew up in Los Angeles. And growing up in Los Angeles, I often felt that Israel was just a suburb of Los Angeles. There were so many, I had so many Jewish friends there. So I felt some closeness to both places. And had both places killing each other. It was painful. And I really wanted to go there. And I read those Newsweek magazines and saw the photographs. I really wanted to go there because I felt that's where my humanity lied. I felt that I was awakening to my humanity. It was something really vital. This pain I felt in my heart was so precious. And I wanted to go very much. Just to be there in the middle of it. But you know, we don't have to look so far away to find suffering. And I think all of us here are here at Tassajara because of suffering in our life. And either it's conscious or unconscious, but I think all of us know it very well. And there's just suffering in small ways. The smallest wantings and not wantings is suffering. You know, when we sit here and, you know, we don't want the period to end. We don't want to have kinhin or we don't want to have soji. That's a form of suffering, not wanting. Or we're sitting here and we want the period to end quicker and sooner. It's too long. That wanting is also a kind of suffering. There's many, many kinds of suffering in our lives. On the other hand, there's just lots of joy. And for me to come to Tassajara and see the effort and intention of all these people here, and see that there's actually this, people are opening up to this vast beauty. We don't usually use the word purity or purification of the mind at Zen Center, but to sense this purification process going on and see it in other people and see the happiness that it seems to bring many of you brings me much happiness. It's kind of a joyful feeling. And feelings of friendliness that I never had before, kind of feeling of extending warmth and love that I never had before, I started to feel when I started practicing. So this vitality, which I just love it with this vitality that I've gotten from having this rich, somehow emotional life. For me, one of the joys of practice has been living in a monastery. I know it often isn't easy to live in a monastery like Tassajara or other monasteries, but the joy for me comes from giving myself completely to the monastery as much as I can. And especially Tassajara, that means giving yourself to a schedule. And the schedule is pretty tight. There's very little time for personal concerns. And so you give yourself as much as you can, as totally you can. And that giving, there's this lightness that happens. It's freeing up the mind of a lot of the petty concerns or gross concerns we have, self-centered in some way. And the more I did it, the more you do it, the more this lightness of the mind happens, this buoyancy, freedom of the mind happens. And the more the mind becomes buoyant and free, the more open it is, the more open the heart is, and the more sensitive you get to many things. And one of the things you become sensitive to is very small sensual pleasures. Just this morning, eating orioki, after my food had been served and all the food was in the bowls, it was just exquisitely beautiful. It's kind of silly to talk about how beautiful it is, because it's a little bit irrational, but it's just like a middle bowl with those bananas coated with yogurt. They were just glistening. I didn't even want to touch it sometimes because it's just, you know, it was so precious, like jewels there. These three white bowls, three black bowls with white things inside this morning. Or sometimes the way the light comes into the zendo, you know, is exquisite. And these are all kind of sensual pleasures that we can have and enjoy. And monastic life, I think, is full of them because we're open and we're present, for, we try to be, or we tend to be, the more we give ourselves to the monastery, give ourselves to the practice, give ourselves to Zazen, the more we become open to these little joys, little jewels. And the Buddha, he talked about a joy which was even greater than this kind of sensual joy. And another form of giving, and that is when he talked about generosity. He talked a lot about giving and generosity. And it's not something you need to take up as a practice. But you can notice the times in your life when you give freely to something, give some material thing, or give an act of kindness, or give a smile. Or, if you pay attention to your mind at that time, you'll see that the mind is, the moment of giving is very light and very free. It's a moment of non-greed and non-attachment. And it's a moment of non-clinging. And you can feel a very special kind of joy, pleasure, and happiness with that kind of mind. And that pleasure, the Buddha said, is far superior to the world of sensual pleasures. So he encouraged people to incline the mind towards these higher levels of happiness. Incline the mind towards generosity. He said that if people knew the fruits of generosity, the joys that are possible from the acts of giving, you would not, if you knew in the way that I know, you would not let a single meal go by without offering it to someone else. And then there's another form of giving, which is the giving of harmlessness. And this is also one of the very precious things in life, I feel. Very special things that isn't just unique to Buddhism, but it's Buddhism emphasizes it a fair amount. Other religions emphasize it a lot too, but is creating an atmosphere and a feeling of trust, where people can trust that you're harmless, you're not going to harm them. They can trust you. And the Buddha talked a lot about that. And traditionally, Buddha's robes were kind of brown, kind of brownish red, like maybe like Blanche's or Kesa now. And it was like supposed to be kind of the color of the earth. And the idea of this color was that it was a color which was had a harmless feeling to it. The animals, when they walked by a monk, wouldn't feel threatened. So this giving of harmlessness is really a special thing. And the giving of harmlessness is the foundation, or the, in some ways, one of the main motivating factors for following the precepts. And for me, I was very little interested in precepts most of my time at Zen Center. I didn't really have any concern in my life. But now, in the last couple of years, I've begun to appreciate the precepts a lot more, and beginning to understand them as a guideline or an extension of this feeling of desiring to be harmless. And the precepts, the literal word, or the word in the ancient language, Pali language, for precepts is sila. And sila literally means foundation. So sila becomes a foundation for our meditation practice. And there's a kind of happiness that comes from having pure conduct that comes out of the precepts, or naturally comes out of the precepts, comes out of our direct openness to the world. And it's kind of called the happiness of non-remorse. And I think we are who we are, regardless of who we think we are. And oftentimes we try to run away from ourselves, I think, or avoid ourselves, or we just don't know our whole sides. And but one of the things that happens if you do a lot of sitting is that you realize that everything's going to come back to you. That whatever you do is going to come back. And if you've done something which you're not so happy about, a little bit shameful about in the past, you'll find out about it again. And sometimes it takes years and years for it to come surface again. But the more you sit, the more you get into intensive sitting, the quicker these things will come back. Sometimes they can come with a great surprise. And it seems, you know, I don't know so much about these things, but the impression is that it isn't just one lifetime that will come back. Things from former lifetimes will come, it seems. Things from the past, the karma. And so if you've had based your life on precepts, then this remorse won't surface in your sitting. And that's kind of nice, actually. A nice feeling. So it's a feeling of non-remorse, feeling that your conduct has been good. And that's another form of happiness. And I think often in the West, we have a taboo against appreciating ourselves. And it's possible to appreciate ourselves if we think back at our conduct. And we say in the full moon ceremony, all my ancient twisted karma. And the kind of beauty of our conduct, I think, is that all of us in the long distance past or the short distance past, we've all done everything. And all kinds of terrible things. And it doesn't really matter too much. But what matters is, I think, the dedication and the intention to start living an open, pure life, open life based on the precepts right now. If you do that, you don't have to do this, but if you do that, then you have another kind of subtle joy. And it's called the joy of non-remorse. Anyway, so this conduct, life based on precepts, as a foundation for our meditation practice. And it's much easier to be to see reality directly if our conduct has been good. If we don't have an agitated mind that remembers and reflects and feels all kinds of strange things about what we've been doing. And you can see that. I think all of you have probably seen it. Just in our small things we do at Tassajara. Basically, we live a pretty good life here. We don't do too many bad things. But just the way we talk to people and the kind of conversations we have sometimes, you know, you feel, you go sit down in this Zen and you feel it, you've carried with you the feeling or that there's a taste of it. So the more your daily life can be in line with Buddha's way, the more you can have a direct experience of reality in your sitting. And as your sitting develops, there's whole worlds of joy that open up, and whole worlds of suffering. And it's very important not to judge your sitting, because again, experience isn't the experience that counts. And if you think you're having joy, don't judge it as being good. If you think you're having suffering and a lot of pain, don't judge it as being bad. There's just no way of knowing what you're going to experience. And it's out of our control. And this has been one of the great joys. I don't know if that's the right word now, but one of the great sources of vitality for me in practice is that, or in life, is that things are so tenuous. Everything we know is really tenuous. And it's just always slipping away. And it comes completely out of our control. And the more deeper our insight gets in sitting, the more we realize that things are basically out of control, our experience. Things come and go without our wish. And our experiences of our mind, our experiences of our body, we can't really control them. How many of you invited your thoughts you had this morning during Zazen? How many of you invite the pains you have? They come and go out of our control. And then there's this, another part of the tenuosity of what's known is this tension I feel, this great this quivering in the heart of facing the unknown. There's just so much unknown, always on the edge of it. And monastic life, I think, is very much always being on the edge of the unknown. And monastic life is very much has very much an unknown quality. You can't really know what it's about. So as we sit, sometimes we get concentrated, and some of the greatest joys, thrills, raptures that are possible for people are possible in states of concentration. And I don't say this with the idea that you should all sit down and try to attain these kinds of happiness. In some ways they're sidetrack. But some of you experience it sometimes. And it comes from being one-pointed. If our concentration is one point on one object, we develop a happiness of seclusion. Of solitude. Because we're no longer in touch with all the things that distract our mind, all the delusions and heaviness of the mind, distortions of the mind, which weigh us down, which make us unhappy. All those things are kind of put to rest for the time being because we're just focused on one point. And most Buddhist teachers and a lot of Zen teachers make a strong emphasis to stay away from one-pointed concentration. Not always, but there is some value to it. And the value of one-pointed concentration is that from one-pointed concentration, you can develop what's called the four Brahma-viharas, the four boundless abodes. And these are some of the most powerful emotions a Buddhist can feel. And if you think that Buddhism is unemotional, just try to develop some of these emotions. And these four are loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. And when you get really strong, fixed one point of concentration, you can take one of these four emotions and cultivate it and develop it. It becomes the one point you focus on. And they become boundless. And just if you extend it to all realms of the universe, these feelings are extended. And they're inconceivable. And you cultivate ability to develop it. I think, you know, if you can imagine feelings at times when you felt a lot of love, moments you felt a lot of love or friendliness to other people, if you can imagine those moments of having access to them and being able to call them up at will, just you feel a desire for them and you just call them up in powerful states. These are things that are possible from a concentrated mind. But then we come to the most wonderful happiness of them all, and maybe the most subtle, and that's the happiness of Zen practice. And maybe some of you have been wondering where the happiness of Zen practice is. I think that the happiness of Zen practice comes from simply being in touch with what's real. A Rev said in the Abhidharma class, it's all illusion. But anyway, in touch with what's real. And again, having in a very radical way, unconditionally accepting what's happening in the present moment. And again, this open mind and open heart. And It's a kind of coming home. It's a settling down. Coming to rest at what's happening each moment. Directly in the experience of each moment, coming to rest. Feeling this is our home. It doesn't have anything to do whether it's pleasurable or unpleasurable. Some of you maybe have felt. Remember, I felt it very strongly during my Tongariyo here, Dasahara, 8 years ago, that I had a lot of pain. I was reeking with pain. My knees were on fire. And so it was very unpleasant. But it was very real. And I was very happy about this intimacy. I felt very, very intimate with my life. And I was very sad that Tongariyo ended because I was going to lose this intimacy, lose this contact with what I felt was most real. My monastic life is, and my monastery, especially Tassahara, we give ourselves to the schedule. And it doesn't matter if we're tired or have a headache or we're starting to get sick maybe. We go anyway to the Zendo and we sit. That's our basic dedication, our basic purpose for being here. And it's outside of our judgment, our concerns of whether it's good or bad, or good or bad for us, or whether it's going to be pleasant or not, or whether it's going to be difficult or not. We don't even, to fill our minds with those kind of questions, even to allow the question to rise up in our mind, should I or shouldn't I go to the Zendo, is a source of suffering. It's a suffering mind that has those kind of questions. And there's a joy that comes just going, anyway, just going. It doesn't matter if you don't want to go, just go. And I think it's very important also, if we're really going to be confront our lives face to face and see it and have this direct contact with reality that comes from Zen practice, we have to have some way of stepping outside of our self-centered ideas about what we want and don't want. And so if we have a headache, we come to the Zendo anyway. And you're in touch with what's real. In some ways, you know, oftentimes, I think we trick ourselves. And Zazen often is pretty healing. And if you have a headache, I find it's often just better to come to the Zendo. I might not want to come, but just better to come. And often I feel better afterwards. Often when I start feeling sick, I go to the Zendo anyway. Sometimes I get sicker. But sometimes, it's healing to be here. It's healing to be choiceless. The healing power of Buddhism comes from being choiceless. So as we sit and start confronting what's real, one of the first things in practice we confront is all our psychological patterns. And it's very important to admit them all and let them all surface, let them all come. And not to get concerned in the content of them, but to be involved in the process of them, see them directly for what they are. And the more we can have this very kind of deep acceptance and love and forgiveness for ourselves, for our personality and everything of who we are, the more we can kind of let all that settle down. And we start seeing the mental side of our life and the physical side of our life. We start seeing how we have expectations and assumptions and projections and ideas and judgments for what's going on. And it's all our mental life. And then there's the physical experience of the body, which we are so much in touch with when we sit Zazen. And as we can be involved in the process of seeing these things, each thing for themselves, one of the things we become very quickly aware of is impermanence, is a fleeting changeableness of what we're experiencing. And the teaching of the Buddha, I think, as I understand it, the whole teaching of the Buddha is based on what we're experiencing. And it's from the point of view of what we're experiencing. And when he's talking about change and impermanence, he's talking about from the point of view of our direct experience. And it's not abstract. It's not conceptual. To see impermanence conceptually and abstractly is pretty obvious. The Buddha didn't have to say that. To see it in a very concrete, non-conceptual way is when Buddhism really starts opening up for us. And Dogen said that too. Dogen said that The thought of enlightenment, bodhicitta, is the mind which sees impermanence directly, not conceptually. In some ways, you don't really have the possibility of practicing Buddhism in a very strict, formal way until you're very, very, very intimate with impermanence. And you see that everything is fleeting. For many people, when they first start seeing impermanence, it fills them with rapture. Because the first thing you start seeing, you tend to see, is just everything just arising all the time. You see it's arising. I mean, just primarily when your mind is very concentrated and very focused and just lighting on the arising of phenomena, moment after moment, sounds and tastes and sights and smells and touches and thoughts, just one after the other arising, everything seems so perfect, so wonderful. And things just open up. There's no more any concept of inside and outside, of body and environment. Just all this stuff happening, this flow of sensations. Things just arising and passing, arising. And it can just be so wonderful, so perfect. And your mind can just be so light, so filled with rapture. Anyway, it's a very wonderful time of practice for Zen students. The danger is of getting stuck in it, getting caught in it. Either holding on to it when it's happening, or thinking that, oh, this is what my practice should be like, and then when it's not happening, trying to make it happen. And that in some sessions, I've gotten headaches, holding on to certain states, or trying to make them happen. But then we keep going. In Zazen, we have a stubborn steadiness. Stubborn, steady commitment, just staying focused on what's happening moment by moment. And not getting caught by any of what we're experiencing. And then impermanence starts revealing its other faces. And the other faces of impermanence are, next one we might see is the rising and passing away of phenomena. And then as our concentration gets stronger, we just see the passing away. Just see things passing away very fast. Our focus, our concentration is so strong that the moment our concentration falls on the object, it's already gone. And it's so strong, you don't even see things arising anymore. Just passing away. Just vanishing so fast. And then you start feeling, you know, we read it today in the book on the Zengi about a flash of a flintstone, a spark of a flintstone. And they talk about in Buddhism a flash of lightning and how reality is a mirage or an echo. I think at this stage, when you start feeling this kind of impermanence, you really start understanding what they're talking about when they talk about a spark of a flintstone, a flash of lightning. Things are just so impermanent. Things are experiencing, is just fleeting so much. And then you start feeling, again, how tenuous things are. The mystery and the unknown that's around us. And you might wonder, sometimes we might wonder what's happened to our practice because we're no longer filled with this happiness anymore that we had earlier, maybe. I remember many sessions I had at the end, usually in the evening, like in the last night, we used to have this open sitting in the end, and I used to have this experience of things just blowing away, just falling away. I felt like I couldn't concentrate on anything. There was nothing I could concentrate on because everything was just going away. You know, it was very strange. So I'd usually stop sitting because I thought I wasn't able to practice anymore because I couldn't concentrate on anything. So I was kind of tricked by this experience. It gets pretty far out, seeing this kind of passing away of phenomena, passing away of experience. It's really far out when you start seeing the mind passing away. And you realize just the mind isn't there. It's just passing away. And you know, you might see the body's passing away, the sensations are passing away very fast. But then the awareness in which sees the sensations passing away, that awareness, not only is it passing away, but it passes away before you even are kind of aware of it. Kind of very strange, kind of paradox. just passing away. Just, and it's very frightening at times. A lot of fear can arise in people because our ideas of self, our ideas of the mind, the concepts of who we are, no longer hold up. There's nowhere we see, there's no place we can rest anymore. There's no abiding place. We can start seeing that in the Diamond Sutra they talk about past mind, future mind, and present mind can't be had, can't be experienced. And now we really understand that present mind, we talk a lot about being present here, but actually you can't be present. And you said you can't catch up to the present even, or experience. And it gets, and at this stage, you can experience a lot of suffering, a lot of pain. And I think one of the things I've learned about practice is very, very, very important is not to judge our experience, because we go through cycles, alternate cycles of pleasure and pain. And there's no way of knowing what's going to come up next. And anyway, at this stage of impermanence, deep, deep penetration of impermanence, the suffering can be tremendous. And much more than I think most people in their daily lives can imagine. And at times, some people, not always, but sometimes, you think you're going to die. And I think for Zen students, if you're really serious about Zen practice, you have to be willing to die. And not just kind of figuratively, but you're actually convinced that if you continue sitting, you're going to die. And but you can't stop. You know you have to continue. You know, even if you're going to die, you have to continue. And many times we come to this place. And if you really completely accept that, completely accept this place, then you can settle down, you fall down into a place of very pervasive equanimity. And this is, and equanimity is a jewel. Is a jewel somehow of the Buddhist emotions. When they talk about the seven factors of enlightenment, equanimity is the king. And then we see things just passing. Things arise and they pass away. There's no reaction to them at all anymore. Absolutely no reaction. Completely effortless. There's no more feeling of effort in our practice. Things come and they go, come and they go. Mind is very light and very clear and a lot of clarity. And from this point, from this kind of equanimity, there's a possibility of getting a glimpse of the unborn, and the uncreated, of emptiness. And I think emptiness, the unborn, is the greatest happiness. It's the most beautiful thing. I think it must be that way. And so I'd like to end just with a poem. By Ryokan. My hut lies in the middle of a dense forest. Every year the green ivy grows longer. No news of the affairs of men. Only the occasional song of a woodcutter. The sun shines and I mend my robe. When the moon comes out, I read Buddhist poems. I have nothing to report, my friends. It wasn't the right poem. Here's the next one. Kind of strange to be up here. A cold night, sitting alone in my empty room, filled only with incense smoke. Outside, a bamboo grove of 100 trees. On the bed, several volumes of poetry. The moon shines through the top of the window. The entire neighborhood is still, except for the cry of insects. Looking at this scene, limitless emotion, but not one word. limitless emotion, but not one word. Anyway, so Buddha's way for me is just packed full of emotion, limitless emotion. Does anybody have any questions? Or any comments?
Use the word heart. Many people use it. To me, it's sort of a black box. It contains a lot of stuff, but it obscures it. So, I was wondering what you mean.
It's like the word God, right?
Right. Our practice.
Our practice.
Yeah.
Well, I like to use it together with the word open. It's an open heart. And it has to do a lot with the feeling here. This area here of my body has tended to vibrate a lot more since I started practicing than ever before. And so there's something here which I feel is very special. So it's like the word heart refers to this vibration and warmth, tenderness here. But I think open heart is this quality of not reacting to our experience, not pushing anything away, not holding on to anything, not picking or choosing. And when you have that quality, that for me is the definition of an open heart or openness in Buddhism. Right.
It seems like a big paradox in this is when you do react to something, where you do have emotions or reactions, but maybe the thing is not to push them away or react to that. And to stay away from a preconception of equanimity or preconception of emptiness.
Absolutely. The last thing you want to be involved in as instance is preconceptions. So I think you're saying is very right. And it's out of our control anyway. We don't know what we're going to experience. We don't know if there's going to be equanimity or reaction or hate or anger. And those things just happen, and but we just at some point we don't get involved in the chain. I think that's what you're saying. There's no chain effect that goes down the line forever, and that's what samsara is. It's a chain effect that goes down forever. So you know, at some point or other, we just let things be.
Yes, I do like your emphasis on how we shouldn't judge or condemn. Negative experiences of suffering as bad. And I think of Bodhidharma saying that when we experience such, we're really burning up, taking care of that negative karma from the past. It's not an occasion to judge it bad. So.
Yeah, that's right.
I hear you speak of this one point of concentration that you are talking about and the experiences that come from it. I experience the mind saying, yes, I'd like to have that. I'd like to attain that or bring that about. And what is this?
What is it?
What is this wanting that I want?
It's greed.
Mm-hmm. Why do you put these things out for me? Do you greedy about it? Well, how does that fit into, to this whole uh,
It's not necessarily greed. It can be taken up from a place of non-greed. Like, for example, one of the things you develop from one point of concentration, if possible, is these Brahma Viharas, tremendous feelings of compassion, loving kindness. And some people, some Buddhists, will develop concentration, one point of concentration, in order to try to help other people, to be benefits to other people by developing these qualities. And so it's not necessarily greed. Maybe you're doing it from a great bodhisattvic mind. I don't know. But for the most part, as I said, most Zen students, most Zen teachers, I think, and most Buddhist teachers tend to shy away a little bit from excessive one-pointed concentration, because it's very little wisdom arises in one-pointed concentration. You're fixated, your mind is like a rock, you're fixated on one thing. The only thing you know is that one thing, and it's permanent. You don't see it as changing, you don't see its impermanence, you're just really hooked on it. And what we're interested in more is a fluid mind, a mind that's more like water. They can see everything as it is, as it arises, and see its fluidity, see its changingness, see its true nature. You can't really see anything's true nature when you're excessively one-pointed. So the joys I was talking about from that kind of comes when the mind is extremely one-pointed. And it happens at times to people, and if it happens, it's nice. If it doesn't, it's okay.
It even has a feeling for me that if one wants to develop concentration so that they can develop loving kindness or these qualities, it still has that feeling of wanting.
It depends who you're doing it for. There's wholesome wanting. There's a feeling and some confusion in Buddhism about the word desire. And because the problem is that the Buddhist word for desire was translated as desire. And there's other words. Desire is too big of an umbrella. It includes too many things. And when it says, the Four Noble Truths, that the cause of suffering is desire, it isn't exactly desire, it's a clinging, which is unwholesome. There's also very wholesome wantings, desires. And like there's dharma, chanda, the desire, or the zeal, or the desire for dharma practice. And it's considered wholesome. And they're not necessarily coming from a selfish place. And so there's a whole range of ways you can be engaged in the world, which is not selfish, but still full of desire or intention. And once you step out of the way, and for me, that's I practiced for many years. I think I was telling someone recently, yesterday maybe, to Kosho. When I, for years at Zen Center, I thought it was really insincere to take up any kind of practice, except just being present. My practice was to unconditionally be present, unconditionally accept the present moment. And to take up any other practice, take up even the attempt to interest, to get concentrated, or to do the precepts, or to develop the paramitas, to me was kind of a perversion, because it was adding something to our life, and it came from some kind of desire. All I wanted to do was just accept what's happening right now. And so for years, I had very poor concentration in my sitting because I wasn't interested in concentration. And probably my practice was much purer back then than it is now, because I shouldn't be so concerned about concentration if it's for selfish reasons. And but then at some point I realized that the boundaries of self and other start breaking down, and you see that you have effect on other people, and you want to do something for other people, you want to help other people or support them in their practice, or it's like cultivating a garden. You want to have a garden, so weeds are okay to have, and some gardeners leave all the weeds there, but also it's okay to pull the weeds, and it's also okay to cultivate certain qualities. And the desire for that can come from a wholesome place. But I think mostly Zen teachers will will ask you to avoid cultivating any particular qualities, especially in the beginning of your practice, because it's a little bit of a distraction from the main point, which is just to see the reality directly for what it is. So it's best just to avoid any kind of desire, even wholesome ones, and just be committed in this real stubborn and steady way to direct confrontation, direct intimacy with our reality. Right?
About following the schedule being a good monk, sort of thing. Something that's happening for me is loosening up a little bit about, for example, how servers are serving and how sokus are sokuing during the meals and other things. I find that I have gotten a bit fixated on these kind of observations and sort of maybe and to go in the opposite direction. Sometimes when I notice I'm getting kind of fixated on some of this, I look out the opaque windows instead, or I look at the ceiling, or I become aware of the world is much larger than this. And I suppose maybe I'll go through a cycle of this sort of fixation and trying to get away from this. But can you say something about perhaps when it's good to look up the walls of the valley of the skies?
I think it's good if you're judging too much. Part of the purpose of these forms, the monastic forms, is you just do them wholeheartedly, and or attempt to do them wholeheartedly. I mean, lots of mistakes are possible. You make mistakes all the time. You read the wrong poems, and but the point of these things is so that we don't judge our life anymore. So it's one of the greatest mistakes is to do these forms and then judge ourselves for doing them wrong. So if you're judging the forms and getting involved too much in judging them and criticizing people or yourself, you know, a good antidote would be maybe to do what you're doing, look out the window or the ceiling, to kind of come back to a more non-judgmental way. And so that's a good thing. And which brings up a point. Sometimes you see Doans. Doans make a lot of mistakes, and I remember at Green Gulch, also here, Doans make mistakes, and but sometimes the Doans do a terrible thing. It's the worst things the Doans can do, and it's kind of their death, the death of a Doan. and the death of a Doan is when you hit the wrong bell and you go, that's the death of a Doan. Hitting the wrong bell is fine. That can actually be the moment of birth for the Doan. But the moment of going, that's the death of a Doan. Some of the Doans around here have died a few times. Yeah, and they get reborn really wonderfully. A really great group of born again Doans.
When you were talking about the colors of the robes, it brought to mind that bees react most violently to black. Do you know where the black came from?
It's something in China. Something happened in China. I think. Maybe, I don't know. I've heard some various things through times, but I don't remember them so well. Something about, you know, in Japan, I think, I don't know, you know, black is, you know, Vanya? Anybody else know? You should ask someone who might know. I don't really know.
The Buddha had orange, right?
Kind of orange or brown or...
Yeah. It's relevant that monks wear robes, black robes, because they're happy.
Good. And I think in Japan, people get married in black, whereas in we get married in white, right? So there's a different associations with colors. Is that right?
Black is Confucian, and the idea of Confucius was that black absorbed all colors.
Yeah, black absorbs all our emotions. What's left is happiness. And it's true. When everything else drops away, you know, there was a time in my practice where I tried to prevent joy from arising. I thought it was, kind of silly to get kind of happy and joyful. And I was kind of sober and I really wanted to kind of get going. And it's not possible to avoid joy. The vine, when it opens up, but you have this opening happen, you go through a period of joy. And it's inevitable. And so don't avoid it, but don't get caught in it. And the ideal thing would be if you could pass through it quickly. In a couple of minutes, the ideal thing was just to let it go and move on. Unfortunately, we often get stuck, even in good feelings. If you're distracted, your mind just jumping all over the place usually.
No, I meant that if you're staying with reality, that is what's happening in the moment, how is that different from one point of concentration?
Oh, there's two kinds of concentrations. There's one point of concentration, which fixates on one object.
Right.
And the other one is called momentary concentration, moment-to-moment concentration, which rather than selecting and staying over time with one object, you're just open to whatever is happening moment to moment as it arises. And if you're open to the changing nature of our experience, there's this constant stream.